podcast lovers, aficionados, academics, and producers. This is New Oral Cultures. Welcome back to New Oral Cultures. I'm Dario Linares. So how are you all doing? I've had a tough one this week, I have to say. And yeah, well, whereas my particular existence is not as hard as many people's during this period, you know, I've got the privilege to be able to work and earn money still from home. Still, whatever your circumstances are, it's always everyone's relative anxiety is valid, I think. And yeah, I just felt like this week that even though maybe the week before there was a little bit of optimism when it came to the vaccine program rolling out, and you know, there's these discussions about what is going to happen in the summer. But just this week, I don't know what it's been, but every interaction I think has been difficult, whether it's been teaching or, you know, speaking to colleagues or whatever it might have been, and even at home. And it's just like, I think everybody is just at the point of being kind of done. Everybody's just really had enough. And I think it's becoming more and more difficult to be empathetic. Everyone has got something that's going on. And obviously that is the most prominent thing in everyone's life, what your own personal concerns are. And I think this has been going on for so long. It's like becoming, people are kind of looking inwards and thinking to themselves, how am I coping? What am I going to do? And I think that's just totally natural. And particularly dealing with the students this week has been really, really difficult. I've had to have conversations with students who literally have no money. And what do you say to that? You know, I sit here and I'm relatively okay, and I have no control over the financial organization and the communications of the university. So I can't go anywhere and say, look, you have to do this for this student. And I have even less control over what the government does, obviously. And we were sat down watching the TV the other night, and I said to my partner, you know, I'm speaking to students who literally don't have any money, and you know, they're balancing this, trying to balance this life out of going to university and doing this thing that's supposed to enhance their life chances, but yet they just do not have the, you know, on the Maslow hierarchy of needs, they're quite low towards the bottom of trying to just literally exist at the moment. And we were looking online about the, you know, the government support for students, and it was like £70 million. And if you actually work that out, so, you know, at the university that I work at, we have 25,000 students, and let's say conservatively that there are 10% of those who are struggling. That's 2,500 students. Then you average that out to, let's say, again, it's a ballpark figure, you make that 100 universities times 2,500 students. Suddenly the divvy up of 70 million quid is nothing. It's next to nothing. It's token. And then they have to fill out these ridiculous forms to be able to get that money, accounting for everything that they've done and everything that they've spent. And it's like, oh, we have the bin men outside. Let's take a little break, and maybe they'll say something interesting. So a little intervention of realist sound effects there, but nothing particularly interesting was said. So where was I? Yeah. So when you know, you work out how much this is actually available for students in this particular context, it is literally next to nothing. And it's really hard to know what to say in that situation. It's like, yeah, we want you to be at university, and you know, it dawns on them that they are within. They are in now a financial arrangement with a service that is being provided to them, you know, and we all hate using that kind of language, I think, in university. I think, well, most people do. But that's the interaction, the transactional nature of the relationship, and the university communications are in that kind of vein. So, you know, if they're not paying their fees, it's like, where are your fees? You will not be able to go to university, in this very matter of fact, you know, there's no humanity behind the communications kind of way. And it's, you know, it's absolutely dreadful. And it really sort of speaks, I think, to the way in which schools and universities are within the sort of neoliberal economy are just kind of accreditation management, and they are the, for the universities, they are the commodity. And if they're not paying the fees and they don't have the financial means to be able to support themselves to go to university, all that's being said to them really is, here's a little bit of hardship cash if you can manage to fill out that form, this humiliating form, as I say, that gets them to outline exactly all of their spending. I certainly wouldn't want to do that, that's for sure. But then if they can't do that, and it's kind of like, well, you're on your own, and it really sort of does make you realize how individualized as a society we are. And I think some of that has hit me in terms of conversations that just generally I've and the difficulties of them I've been having this week. And it's just has seemed kind of endless, without kind of, I don't want to go on about it too much, but I just wanted to kind of speak about this because I know there's lots of people who are feeling the same way. And reading the paper yesterday about the feelings that teachers have and higher education lecturers and staff in all walks of life. But, you know, I'm talking about this because this is the field that I'm in, and most of the listeners will be in, that it's difficult to know what the future holds, really, because these workloads, and they are not going to go anywhere. And the way that we teach is going to have to adapt and have this kind of blended learning approach into the future. And I can't see anything really changing much for me, particularly because I think that I'm not somebody who teaches practice, for example. And we've already been told that next year the practice courses are going to get, or the practice modules are going to get priority when it comes to face-to-face teaching. So my working life now has changed, and it's going to be working from home the majority of the time. So I'm just kind of, coming to terms with that idea. But hopefully, things will be open and you can get out and go and work in different. So throughout this week and the kinds of conversations that I've been having across the board, I've been thinking about this idea of how we speak and what position we speak from, and the context that we're in when we speak, and whether that gives us power or takes power away from us. And the very nature of how we speak and how we have to be accountable and responsible to that, and how we're living in an era where that there is these endless battles over free speech, but yet the goalposts of this notion of accountability of that speech is something that's being contested. And there is a lot of contradictory narratives out there. When you think about the way that free speech is being weaponized, and we have this sort of sense of free speech absolutism from the libertarian side. But I think there's always been limits on free speech, and there's always been a sense in which that idea of how we speak has a sense of responsibility, and that is a good thing. We should be accountable to the things we say. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of, let's be honest, white straight men find difficult, is that this level of accountability is coming back on them, perhaps for the first time. And it's something I've been thinking about a lot as a white straight man, but particularly this week because of the recordings that I've been doing, one for my other podcast, which is The Cinematologist, most of you will know. But I did an episode this week with an interview talking about sexual representation in the cinema. I interviewed a really fantastic female film critic called Beatrice Loaiza. And kind of leading up to that, I was thinking about the tone and the tenor and the subject area of the conversation, and how to ask certain questions and how to get into it, and how to challenge maybe certain ideas and present certain narratives, I think, that maybe you could speculate that society has that are maybe negative, and some of the problems of talking about sexuality, but how to do that in a measured way, and wanting to be precise and not wanting to be flippant or even clumsily offensive. So there's a kind of anxiety to this speech, which again, I think is not, on the one hand, you could say, am I being censorious? If we're, this notion of total freedom of speech really sort of alludes to the idea that you can just say whatever you want and it's up to the other person not to get offended or it's their problem. But really, when you're having a dialogue and you're having a conversation, you have to be reliant to a certain extent on a level of trust in the other person, particularly if there is something contentious which you want to address and get into the weeds. Now, don't get me wrong, I think that there is a lot of room for argument and debate and, you know, vigorous argument. And obviously, particularly in the political sphere, that is absolutely vitally important. But I think in academia and particularly in sort of fields of sociology and the arts and culture, the ideas of representation and identity are contested areas. The ability to be able to put one's point across in a forthright way, but also have that reacted to in a way that presupposes that you are coming from a place of good faith, that is vitally important. And I think that that arguably is where a lot of the problems lie in today's culture. It's become more difficult not to just come to the conclusion that someone has an ulterior motive or even be prejudiced to the fact that I am not going to listen to you because you are part of a tribe, organization, identity that I do not trust. And I think that this is one of the things that I think I'm trying to be aware of, is especially when it comes to kind of doing interviews and being a podcaster, is you have to try to assume good faith behind the words of a speaker, even if the words of this that the speaker is uttering are things that you would like to contest or disagree with or even find offensive. Now, this is really difficult because I think there are a lot of people out there who are speaking from bad faith, because we're, you know, we live in this environment now where we have this sort of, you know, again, if you want to use the post-truth or fake news terms in order to understand what is going on in with regards to information and the contested nature of truth. So we've lost that ability, and it's more and more difficult to just give that sense of trust or good faith to the person that you are speaking with. It's almost as if if someone comes from a certain position, then they have to be lying, and it doesn't. And we can't. It's more and more difficult to take something that somebody says at face value, and even, you know, think to yourself, do I disagree with this? But I see the validity of the argument behind it. So all of these things were on my mind when I was talking to Beatrice, and, you know, it was a totally fine interview. But even more so in regards to the conversation that is coming up on this episode. So I spoke to Alyssa Chafee, who is the host and co-producer of the Vagina Museum podcast. Now, I met Alyssa before because she was one of the first people I'd met who was doing a postgrad on podcasting. And she did a master's degree, and her thesis was on audiences for science podcasting and their perspectives of educational value through podcasting. So that was interesting stuff. But I'd seen her post on Twitter, and on her biog it said that she was doing this podcasting and working for the Vagina Museum. So I had a listen, and I just found it really engaging, really well written, really funny, not didactic at all, leaning into the sense that speaking about this subject can be awkward and can be difficult. So I really wanted to talk to her about it. But then I was thinking to myself, does this need to be a woman who interviews Alyssa? Because that kind of dialogue, that kind of dialectic, I think, would produce something completely different, obviously. There would be this shared sense of experience if two women could speak about this subject rather than myself. So I was thinking about this, does it need to be a woman? And then, you know, I actually emailed Alyssa and said, what do you think? And she was like, no, it's totally fine, because, you know, I think it's important that these discussions don't happen in isolation. And I totally agree with that. But I was so kind of not nervous at all, because, you know, like I say, I'm always kind of thinking about how I'm asking things. But I didn't want to make somebody feel intentionally uncomfortable. But to me, in the end, you have to be able to try and get past all that in conversation. If we can only speak to a subject of personal experience, this really undermines the possibility of a sense of empathy and understanding. And furthermore, then you're enhancing the silo culture that I think generally in media communications, but particularly in podcasting, I think we have the opportunity to try and address. So that's the interview that I have coming up today. And it's a really, really interesting, great interview. There's a little bit of lag on the line. So that was one thing we had to deal with. So I thanks to Alyssa for kind of working around that. And also I played another blinder with my podcast production, which is that I didn't have the right mic setting on, so I recorded this through my computer. So my voice sounds a little bit tinny here, a little bit more caustic perhaps than it even usually does. So I hope that's not too off-putting. But just before we get to the interview, I actually wanted to just mention one podcast that I've listened to recently, which is the most recent episode of the Blind Boy podcast, which is called, beautifully titled, Basil's Fart Carnival. Now, those of you who know me know that I'm a big fan of this podcast, have been for a long time. And I think this one is just really interesting in the context of talking about education, really. And it's Blind Boy is outlining in a kind of confessional way the experiences he had of growing up and going to school in Ireland and the class biases and the traditional respect for authority that actually ended up making it extremely difficult for him to assimilate into the system, and the ways that he tried to assimilate and the ways that that were rejected because of class prejudice, essentially. And it really brought home to me a lot of things that I think I've thought about education from my past, but also the way that we teach now, and just realizing that the institutional framework of education is not something that suits everyone's learning and suits all children's psychology. And I think it's, you know, because we live in a system where it's very different, very difficult to cater to the needs of every student individually. I think this is the problem that we can't, that, you know, this is always a perennial problem, but it's something I think that, especially I think post-pandemic, that needs to be looked at. And, you know, again, maybe it's pie in the sky to think that will ever happen, because we just seem to be going through a period now where everything is going back to very old-fashioned ways of thinking. But yeah, just the podcast is really, really vital, I think, in terms of understanding how education as a hierarchy works for some people in certain positions and definitely does not work for others. So that's the most recent episode of the Blind Boy podcast. Okay, so let's get into the interview now. So this is me talking to Alyssa Chafee, who is the host and producer of the Vagina Museum podcast. Enjoy. So, Alyssa, thanks so much for coming on New Oral Cultures podcast. It's great to talk to you again.
It's great to be here.
Obviously, I'm really interested to speak to you about the Vagina Museum podcast. I've been listening to it over the last week. So much to kind of ask about your own style and the production and what underpins the kind of ethos of it in relationship to the museum, but also, you know, these questions of body positivity and health consciousness and all of that kind of stuff. But I know, obviously, we've spoken before because you did an MA in podcasting. I just wondered if you could sort of maybe talk a little bit about how your interest in podcasting came about and then how you ended up doing that particular course.
Yeah, so I would say my interest in podcasting came about with just listening, just being like a voracious listener of podcasts starting in university and just loving that ability to learn and be entertained and just have access to such a diversity of content. And then my master's, which was in media and communication, I just kept gravitating towards doing projects where I could interrogate these ideas myself. And that's what led me to do my final project, which was on science podcasts specifically.
Yeah, and it was interesting because I was just reading the abstract again and a little bit of the introduction, and that question about how audiences use podcasting or what they consider the reason is why they're listening is often quite different to what producers and hosts or, you know, the makers of the podcast actually kind of think is what audiences are interested in. And I wondered, do you think that that has borne out with regards to your transition into being a producer and host yourself? Are you, do you feel yourself kind of aware or thinking quite a lot about what you think audiences might want?
You know, I bet I've fallen into the habits of most of the other producers, actually, because with the first season of the Vagina Museum podcast, it really has just been like an introduction to the kind of diversity of topics that the Vagina Museum will hopefully be able to explore over the coming years. And, you know, we always have our listeners in mind in our approach to these topics and being very careful with like the language we're using and our style. Sure. But yeah, I think that there's, you know, probably more room to think about the listeners, actually. reflecting on my master's thesis. Yeah, just like as myself thinking about why I choose to listen and then hearing why other people choose to listen. And just, yeah, the importance of, yeah, that combination of both information and being educational, but also entertaining, I think really came through with that whole process. And I like to think that is something that we're doing with the Vagina Museum podcast. Of course, you know, probably need a listener perspective to see if that was the case.
One of the interesting things I want to talk about a little bit later is that idea of storytelling and history and the notion of has podcasting kind of created, maybe not created, but kind of reminded us about the sort of sense in which knowledge and information always comes within a context. So even if we think something is, whenever we sort of think about knowledge and education, we tend to kind of associate it with this sort of dry delivery. And if it hasn't got that sort of lectury didactic context around it, it's seen as somehow dumbing down. But it seems to me that was one of the things that you were interested in your thesis. And also it definitely underpins the podcast that you're now producing.
I think absolutely. To me, it's really important that something can be academically robust, but also entertaining and engaging and relevant and relatable to the people who are listening. And that, you know, I think our audience is largely 20 to late 40s, people who are in the workforce, professionals. And, you know, I think that's the kind of content that they would lean towards as well.
Tell me a little bit about the Vagina Museum itself. How long have you worked there? You know, what's your role within that? And I don't know, within especially in the last year with the pandemic going on, the sort of position of museums and the cultural industries more generally is precarious, isn't it? Beyond the obviousness of what the title states, you know what I mean? What's the sort of underpinning to this museum and its aims?
Yeah, so the Vagina Museum was founded by Florence Schechter, who was originally a science communication YouTuber. And she saw that there was just a total lack of information about the vagina online. And that was because she was doing this YouTube series on like 10 funny or amazing facts about penises. And she tried to reflect that for a series about vaginas. And she just couldn't. There just wasn't the content available. And that's what started it. And then it was seen that there's a penis museum in Iceland, I do believe. And just trying to say, you know, like, these things exist for phallic elements. Why can't we do the same for gynecological? So that was sort of like the initial thing that ignited the Vagina Museum.
Sure.
And then from there, it was, you know, the goal of the Vagina Museum is to educate people about gynecological issues, to destigmatize conversations around our bodies, especially people with vulvas or vaginas, or vulvas and vaginas, I should say. And to be a space where people can talk about feminist, queer, intersectional issues, and just be a space that's warm and welcoming to like a diversity of people, because there's, you know, not so many of these out there that are accessible and open to everyone. Yeah, so my role at the Vagina Museum is as the podcast host and producer, It's sort of, I guess you could say, my side hustle. I have a 9-to-5 job that takes up the majority of my time. And that's my role with the museum founder and the curator. And I do the podcast with my co-producer, Hannah Hethman, who creates podcasts for museum and cultural spaces full time.
So was the idea for the podcast something that you brought to your boss essentially and said, look, I'd like to do this in my spare time, or, you know, as an addendum to the role, because I think it would be, you know, a help to kind of expand the knowledge and the outreach of the museum? And how much was that a desire for yourself to go into the research around the vagina as a, you know, biologically, but also as a cultural, how the way it's been sort of culturally defined over the years historically?
So yeah, I guess the story of how the podcast came to be is I was actually a volunteer with the museum back in, I think, 2018. So I was a volunteer explainer. We would go to events like Science Museum Lates, that kind of thing, or the British Science Festival. I believe the exhibition also, it was a traveling exhibition. It went to Green Man and other places as well. And it was in conversation with Florence that we were talking about how she wanted to do a podcast. And it sort of went away after that. And I was thinking, oh, like, that's interesting. You know, the Vagina Museum would like to do a podcast. And at this point, it wasn't a physical space. And then the next time we were together, I sort of said that I would love to be a part of that. I had a background in podcasting from my master's, a little bit of understanding of the theoretical aspects of it. And I'd love to help make that happen for the Vagina Museum. And we began the podcast before they had secured its physical space. The Vagina Museum is based in Camden Market. So the podcast we saw as a way to sort of launch alongside the physical museum and to just expand the audience and reach of the museum as it was first opening its doors, and just sort of start those initial conversations for the kind of content and the tone of voice that the museum might have. Their first exhibition was all about busting myths around the vagina overall. And this series was just sort of touching on some of these myths, but then also other aspects like histories and social issues associated to the vagina. And I should say, just to give a little bit of biological background, that the Vagina Museum is called that because it has quite a big impact name. And that's a word we're really familiar with, just like, you know, vagina, penis, these are the words that we sort of equate to each other. But actually, vulva is the external part of the gynecological anatomy. And then the vagina is the first internal canal.
No, I was, I've learned so much over the past week in terms of listening to your podcast. It's been really interesting, to say the least. What also struck me, and, you know, we had a little bit of a conversation about my identity and me interviewing you about this subject area. And it's interesting to me then that the museum and the podcast is really interested, and it's sort of central to the ethos of, as you say, kind of myth busting. And that to me seems to come from the assertion that the vagina is something that is still, among women as much as men, a kind of taboo subject, and something that's not really fully understood in terms of its history and indeed, it's sort of biological function.
Yes, I would definitely say that there is still a lot of taboo around the word vagina, but then also that part of people's body, roughly half the population's bodies. And that's why it was so important for this museum and for the podcast to exist, because it addresses that upfront, you know, bold. It's literally the name of both the podcast and the space. This is a body part that people often aren't even willing to talk about when it comes to their own health. You know, I've seen that chatting with friends and people's fears around going to the doctor for issues relating to their bodies, their vaginas and their gynecological health. Even talking with my own mother about her not wanting to go to the doctor or her struggling to voice with doctors issues with her body. And I think that's a big part of why we have the name that we have and why we talk about the subjects that we do.
The first thing I kind of noticed, and maybe we can sort of talk about your the development with the producer, Hannah. And it's you work as well, don't you, freelance a little bit in terms of working with this company, Bitter Lemon Audio Creative, which is a company that is, from what reading online, it's a podcast production company that does deal with sort of museums and heritage as its kind of specialism in terms of production. So when you were working in that context and thinking about what you wanted this to sound like, what were some of your conversations in terms of the sort of early development?
So Hannah, my co-producer, is the sort of creator of Bitter Lemon Audio Creative, and her whole background is doing podcasts for museum spaces. And so it was with her that we started to think about what we wanted the podcast to sound like and what kind of structure we wanted to give it. And I think for everyone involved, a really important element was that it be, a little bit like playful and personal, even as we're talking about what can be taboo subjects, what can be difficult topics, to just to make it warm and welcoming, and to also just sort of be a bit tongue-in-cheek when we're talking about something that people might be a little bit uncomfortable first engaging with.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the real clear, obvious stylistic things at the beginning. And, I have to say that I was kind of laughing along, to the script, because I think it's really, really well written. And me and my partner on The Cinematologist have just done an episode on sex in cinema, right? And we were trying so hard to be very careful about not sort of including puns and double entendres and, treating the subject with respect and all of that kind of stuff. And it was so nice to hear your script just leaning into that and being, we're going to use these phrases and these terms and not be afraid of that and not be kind of po-faced about making it kind of funny. So I think it's beautifully written in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I love a pun. Hannah loves a pun. So I think we almost couldn't avoid being a little bit silly at times with the language we used. And it was just really important to us, just to reiterate, about taking these taboo and serious topics and making them just fun and engaging and something that you can just have a bit of a laugh about when appropriate. Of course, there's times when we're talking about serious issues where we do pull back on the funny phrases and puns.
What's interesting about the production, I think, it does remind me quite a lot of the NPR style in terms of your voice is, you've got such a great podcast voice in that sense, and you could have been straight from NPR in that regard. But also the way that it's part scripted, but then there are guest interviews with experts, but the experts don't talk. I mean, I'm assuming that you ask them the question and that is recorded, but then your questions are not in the actual edit. It's just them giving their answers, as it were, and then that's scripted inside alongside your narration. So yeah, I was just wondering about that in terms of how long does it take a production to come together, and was that always the kind of plan?
The style of the podcast, having recorded interviews interspersed with our story through narration, or our narration, which is a story, was always sort of the plan. It takes quite a bit of work for each episode to be that final product, I think, because of those stylistic choices that we made. I was just going to say thank you. I remember recording my first ever podcast episode, and I naturally talk extremely quickly, and I know I don't always pronounce my words very clearly. So I thought I sounded like a chipmunk. Just like on like 5 cups of caffeine when I was recording the first episode. So, thank you for saying I could be on NPR. That's what I was going to say. Yeah, but so when it comes to the actual production, the way that the podcast came together was especially because the first series was created before the first exhibition was made for the museum. We decided the kind of range of topics we wanted to discuss. And I went away and did some initial research on roughly a dozen potential subjects that we could get into. And we ended up choosing a sort of a variety of topics. We chose for the first season because the museum is sort of in its nascent stage and it was still blossoming and working to open its doors, that we would cover a few different types of topics. So we have a few episodes that really focus on a historical element, like our podcast on Merkins, which is pubic hair wigs, essentially, and another episode we did on the myth of the Victorian vibrator. And then we chose to do a couple that had to do with wellness and sort of modern issues and the history of how we came to be at this point in time. So, for example, looking at the practice of yoni steaming and placenta eating. So that's how we sort of came to that point in time. Yeah, I think that's the last one that's out. We have one more episode that's going to come out. The pandemic's really slowed us down. You think we'd have more time to work on this, but actually it slowed down our production quite a bit. So we found our topics, went away, did some research, found people to interview. But then through those conversations, it always led to like a final investigation. So I would say that there's three phases to our research, which meant that we have quite a long production process, because there's that initial research stage where we sort of honed in on what we wanted to talk about, the research phase around finding the people and the main points of conversation for our researchers and our interviews. And then after we've done all of that and we're bringing the script together, there's this moment where we do this final moment of it almost felt like investigative journalism, like a very light touch version of it, where we have to just really like deep dive into some of the things that we've come across and the things that people are saying. So to give an example, one of the episodes that we got into was about yoni steaming or vaginal steaming, which is this this practice of people sort of sitting over a pot of steaming herbs. And it's believed to help with a number of things, such as detoxing the body. There's a lot of language around the wandering womb and it just being like something that could help with health issues and stuff. So, you know, that was our initial entry point. And that was a big conversation, actually, a few years ago now. I think it was 2014, where Gwyneth Paltrow was selling yoni steaming products on her site Goop, which is, you know, always a contentious place. And I think it's in the news these days again. It wasn't a new point. But what we were able to do is we read through all those articles that were created at the time, and big names in this field of wellness and like gynecologists who write pieces on this kind of content always reference the same sources. So what we then did is, you know, we reference these sources ourselves, but then we were able to take that extra step and go to those sources and the sources of those sources to really see where that initial information was coming. And it just led to just absolutely fascinating discoveries, such as the link of yoni steaming to this ancient idea of the wandering womb that I think have been lost in translation. So we're able to just take all those extra steps back to that really early idea. And, you know, the wandering womb is an idea that's been around since the ancient Greeks.
One of the things that I think I really appreciate about the podcast, and I think it's almost something that could be further study could be done on, is the way that you actually acknowledge the kind of historicity of the sources that you're using, and the way that you kind of caveat or actually interrogate the level or the status of validity of the sources that you're citing. One of the ways I think podcasting is really useful in encapsulating the nuances and the complexities and even the contradictions of knowledge, which, you know, in academic terms can often be it's this, this, and this. Yeah, it's really fascinating that you do that, and you kind of say, this is what people think and this is where it comes from, but this is the problem with this source. And that's quite a tricky thing to do without it becoming quite dry and boring. Was that always a sort of thing that you had in mind, that look, we have to kind of challenge the veracity of the sources that we're citing here and say, you know, that we can only depend on them to this extent?
This, I think, is something that sort of just happened naturally. I don't think we went in with the idea that we'd have to challenge our sources and acknowledge to what level they are valid or not. But in the process of researching and preparing these podcast episodes, it just is something that we had to do. We had the time to do it because we're a podcast and, you know, we can put things out on our own schedule. And it just seemed like the right thing to do as well. And I would say this is true both for sources where we are from the outset questioning the validity of a source. So, for example, people who say that placenta eating is a positive thing, you know, we were challenging those ideas from the outset. But then also on the other side of it, we were looking at the sources that people were using in the articles to refute that practice. And just through that process going, everyone's citing this one, you know, ancient Chinese text from the 1500s. But actually that person, it was a single person who wrote this text, and he had all sorts of biases of his own that, you know, once we're aware of it, we had to address and we had to bring up. So it was just sort of a natural progression, and it felt like the right thing to do for our podcast.
Yeah, and it just seems so prescient, especially, you know, if you think about what's going on in the news recently, and it seems that there's a cultural drive to narrow the parameters of how you can study history. You know, I'm talking from the right politically. It's kind of like, you know, you cannot challenge the history that we all accept. It seems to be that kind of discourse is becoming more dangerously more and more prevalent. So this is, you know, especially when you're approaching a subject that has been historically taboo, I think it's absolutely, you know, vitally important that you do that. And one of the ways that I found really fascinating was how you challenge that idea that does seem to be almost conventional wisdom, that the Victorian treatment of women's hysteria was the thing that led to the invention of the vibrator. You kind of challenge that and say, look, people have been using quote unquote, you know, versions of the vibrator right back to the Neolithic era. And I have to say, I had to laugh when you said that, you know, women were always using rocks to get off their rocks, you know. It's just, I was chortling along to that one.
See, we do love our puns.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, I think the thing is that history is always written from a certain perspective. It is always going to be biased to some degree because it's individuals deciding what's going to be written down. And they are going to come with their own preconceived notions of what something is or what something means. And it's important as we're discussing these stories that we acknowledge that it is limited to the perspectives of these individuals. And that, you know, that doesn't represent, it's only one aspect of the truth. And the truth will have, you know, 10, 20 other different facets to it as well. It makes me think of what will be in our final episode for this first series, which is about queer people in medieval Christian history, and that these stories were written down in Latin for the most part, and sort of captured and embodied these people as they were, as either queer or trans or however they identified. But then when they were transcribed into English, the Victorians that did that transcription had their own idea of who these people were or how they should have been. So they imposed that upon them. And so now modern historians will look at these texts and people can assume that that's what it was. But actually, if you go back to the original source or if you reflect on visual depictions of these people, it's not so clear cut as the Victorian transcribers set it out to be. So that's the kind of thing that we like to do with the podcast, is just sort of acknowledge those points and the fact that with every translation or reiteration of history, someone is adding their own perspective and opinion and views and biases to that story.
It's interesting how the tone is not to completely debunk the history that you're using, but just caveat it, which I think is really, really useful in terms of presenting the information. In terms of your audience, I mean, it seems on the surface that this would be a podcast that would be aimed pretty much solely at women. But what's interesting, again, in terms of particularly in terms of the way you intro the show, and you sort of talked about this earlier on, is the fact that the ethos of inclusivity is actually part of your kind of introductory statement. And I love that you use the phrase "clitorated people," you know, and there's always kind of ways that you're trying to open the those definitional questions that you know, are at the forefront of conversations about identity all the time right now. So I just wondered, you know, what was, again, the conversation about in terms of who is our audience here and how do we reach our audience and what do we want to do for them in terms of in terms of the kind of podcast this will be?
So I would say that the Vagina Museum's audience is truly just everyone. But of course, not everyone's going to choose to engage with the content. So with the podcast, yes, we know that there is a strong group of people who will likely be people who identify as women, who are cis heteronormative, who will listen to the podcast. But it's so much more than that. The Vagina Museum podcast is for, well, I like to say anyone who knows someone with a vagina. it's for queer people. It's for trans people, because we all have a relationship with this this body part and this cultural idea of what the vagina is. And we think it's quite important that, you know, we make it possible for anyone who wants to engage in those conversations. So, you know, we make the podcast in with an audience in mind of people with vaginas, queer people, trans people. But we really hope that so many more get the chance to have a listen or to think about the different topics and ideas that we're getting into.
Certainly as a straight male listener, I think that, and somebody who considers themselves reconstituted and progressive, let's put it that way, I think that the tone is really useful in sort of perhaps getting past to dealing with female sexuality, which, you know, I think quite a lot of men have difficulty discussing. And I wondered, do you have a lot of interaction with your audience? Do you get, what kind of feedback do you get? The other question I want to ask was, do people listen to the podcast while they're going around the museum?
I don't think they listen to it when going around the museum. So the first season, 3 episodes came out while the museum was still open. And then unfortunately we were hit by the pandemic and the museum doors have been closed now since March 2020 until now. And I know our plans for the second season, if we're able to do it, would be that the content of season 2 reflect the exhibition happening in the museum, in which case it would be lovely for the two series 2 of the podcast to work with the exhibition content. But we, when it comes to the interactions of people with the podcast, it's really interesting. We, you know, there's a very positive group of people who interact with the Vagina Museum on Twitter, and share the content and, you know, delight in the stories that we're sharing, including men. I remember reading a couple of comments from a certain man who just said that, I think it was the episode about vibrators. He was just absolutely delighted to learn about the myths associated with that. And it just made him rethink his relationship to sex toys and sexual pleasure. Because at the end of that episode, we also just talk about modern sex toys and sort of where we're at these days. So we do have those positive interactions. And then on the flip side of that, in the episodes where we've been talking about problematic practices such as yoni steaming or placenta eating, which I think it's pretty safe to say prey on people with vaginas, the wellness industry does a lot of that, and just, you know, people's worst fears and people who struggle to voice their issues, their medical issues, and their relationships with their bodies. So in those episodes, we also have some interesting conversations with people who promote these practices, who have pretty strong opinions on why we're wrong. but it's important, you know, perhaps these people who are, you know, not happy with us online aren't going to change their opinion on these practices. But by talking about these topics, hopefully someone who's considering it or someone who's done it a few times but isn't absolutely invested will just rethink why they're engaging in these practices and if it's a healthy reason or just, you know, other ways they could approach these issues.
Yeah, people do tend to be strident about their opinions when their commercial livelihoods are at stake, I think, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, just to sort of broaden this out a little bit, how do you think that the podcast space, the idea or the potentials of what the podcast offers as a medium, how important and how useful do you think that has been alongside or as an addendum to, or perhaps even at this point kind of on a par with the museum as a kind of physical, I don't want to say old fashioned, but you know what I mean? A classical kind of experience. Does podcasting give something extra and vital that you think is going to be important going forward?
I think that podcasts are a really amazing tool that museums and cultural spaces can use for a number of reasons. They can enhance the stories that a museum is telling. They can offer new layers that you can't get into with a visual exhibition or like a physical space. And they also offer accessibility and inclusivity. And I think in the pandemic, we've seen museums really have to reckon with their identities. You know, a lot of museums are having to acknowledge the role of colonialization in the content they have. They are also spaces that not everyone feels welcome to enter. And they're spaces that some people struggle to navigate because of disabilities or other, you know, physical impairments. So museums are having to reckon with all these different elements during quite a tough year. And I think it's good that they're reckoning with these issues. And what podcasts do is just offer another medium to bring stories and objects and content to audiences, both old and new, to interact with museums. And I think especially for modern museums like the Vagina Museum, which has a sort of a social and cultural issue at its core, podcasts are especially a great way to have conversations about the kind of content of these museum spaces.
Great. Well, Alyssa, thanks so much for taking the time again to speak to me about this. And I highly recommend, and everybody goes and listens to the Vagina Museum podcast. It's really, really interesting, really funny, and really well done. And just to finish off, I just wondered if perhaps you had one or two recommendations or something that you're listening to recently that maybe you could share with our audience.
Yes. So very far from the kind of podcast content that I'm working on, but I absolutely am loving listening to Commons, which is a podcast by Canada Land. And if you didn't know, I'm Canadian in origin. And I love the podcast because I think that Canada has quite a positive image internationally, which is great because, you know, overall, I think Canada is a pretty decent country. But I love Commons because it gets into stories that you maybe don't think about in Canada. So around, you know, police brutality and the RCMP, which is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, about the oil industry in Canada. And it's just a really interesting series that gets into, yeah, stories of a country that you maybe wouldn't hear otherwise.
Brilliant. Alyssa, I hope the lifting of the lockdown means that the museum can open again very soon. And I'm looking forward to season two of the podcast. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me. It's been a really fun hour.